Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm glad that you all came out. As you all are agreeing with your presence here tonight, agreeing this of the significance of parenting, of the need for a focus on parenting. It's what we spend so much of our time in our homes doing, so you might as well learn some of the tools and some of the skills. I want to just start with a story that some of you probably have heard from me before, but it is one of my all-time favorites, and I think of it personally myself all the time. I heard it from Mrs. Becky Udman, who is a woman out of Dallas, who actually is a big proponent of the Love and Logic Method, which we'll be talking about not this week, but probably a little bit next week. She tells a story of a young woman who went shopping. She didn't have any children of her own. She went shopping on a Sunday morning by herself while she thought it would be nice and quiet. And she's going up and down the aisles. And she hears as she's going around that there's a child, probably about 2 or 3 years old, sitting in a cart being pushed by his dad. And the child is just going ballistic, screaming, yelling, kicking the cart, making that clanking noise of the metal. And as she's trying to pick out her fruits and her vegetables, the noise is right next to her, so she decides, you know, I don't necessarily need my fruits and vegetables now. She shifts around to the next aisle, and wherever she goes, following her is this dad with this child. And she hears the father saying, "Don't worry, Marvin, we're almost done. We can manage this. It's not so hard, Marvin. We can do it." And as she's trying to get farther and farther away from the noise and the screaming and the kicking, everywhere she goes, right behind her comes his dad pushing his cart, and she hears him. "Marvin, don't worry. We're halfway done with our list. Marvin, we can make it. We're almost there." She decides, enough already. The store is empty. It's just me and this father and this son. A ton of noise. She goes to check out. And as she's checking out, sure enough, right behind her, pulls up the dad, and his kid is still going at it, and he is saying, totally calm, "Marvin, I can see the car from here. We're done. We made it. We are not going to have to come back here for a week." And this woman is just blown away at how he's keeping his calm. His kid is screaming and yelling and kicking and everything. She goes up to him and says, "You know, sir, I don't know who you are, but I'm just amazed at how you're able to handle your child and stay so calm. Like, what do you do for a living?" So he's like, "Well, really, I'm just like a high school coach down the block. It's really..." Well, embarrassed, she walks away. 2 minutes later, he comes back to her and he says, "You know, ma'am, I'm sorry. Maybe you didn't understand. I'm Marvin." Now, that is my favorite. It's just because I think about that all the time. Because so much, I can make up a percentage, because most percentages are made up. Let's say 89% of parenting is really about staying calm from our end. Because when we lose it, so then, as you've probably all experienced, or if you haven't experienced, you've watched your friends experience, once you lose it, once your kid has gotten you to the point where you are not in control, then there's no hope for anyone. Not just for the kid, not for you. And that story, I always think, okay, remember Marvin, I'm going to be in control. And if you think about it, if you think about being on an airplane, and you're flying wherever you're flying, in the middle of the air, you hear, this is your pilot speaking. And he says as follows. He says, "There's this little red blinking light here on my board. We've tried everything. We went through everything the manual said. Everything seems okay, but we can't get it to stop. So we're going to make a stop. It should take us about an hour until we get it figured out. We're really sorry about the inconvenience, but we take your safety very seriously. So we don't want to continue without really knowing what it is. We're going to make a quick stop, and it'll probably delay us an hour to 2 hours. We're sorry." And your response to that is, right, you're frustrated with the situation, but right, it's under control, and they're going to take care of it. Imagine if in the middle of the air you're flying on your plane, "This is your pilot speaking, there's this red blinking light. I don't know what in the world it means. This is crazy. We're going to stop. We're going to crash land right now. Get it." So if you can imagine your reaction in the back when you'd hear that, like, this is the pilot. If he loses it and he's controlling the flights, like, then you're not calm in the back, just a little bit frustrated with the situation. So we're piloting our homes. Our children, whether we realize it or not, look to us to see how to respond to the situations that we're in. And we often have these red blinking lights that we have no idea what it means. I don't know how to handle this situation. What are we supposed to do here? And you look to your spouse and I don't know. and you may grab a book. I don't know. I don't know what to do. The blinking light. So we can panic. And when we panic, so our kids see that we're panicked, and they panic, just like we would panic if the person who was flying our plane panicked. We would also panic, because the person in charge doesn't know what's going on. And I cannot overstate the value of having in mind as we begin, we're going to be spending a lot of time on practical tools, but just recognizing the value of what it means to the home, to our ability to parents, to be able to stay calm and in control in all of those situations. Because the age bracket that we're talking about, that 2 to 8 stage, it's a trying time, as I'm sure all of you have experienced. And if you haven't experienced, you've seen your friends deal with. It is not always easy, it's difficult. And there's a certain value just to begin with of being able to stay calm. I'll just add one quick Dvar Torah, just as we begin into this week's Parsha. There's a Medrash which says that when the plague of the frogs began, it actually began with a single large frog, and every time the Egyptians would strike the frog, it would split. And then it would split and split and split every time it was struck until the entire land was covered in frogs. That's, Rashi quotes such a statement from our sages, and it always troubled me. How many times do you hit a frog, see that it splits into more frogs, until you say to yourself, that's a bad idea. Let me try something else. Now apparently, according to the sages, it was hit time after time after time after time, so the whole land is filled with it, and I was always perplexed. I don't get it. Until I had children. And then I understood. Because children have an ability to ask and ask and plead and beg and repeat what they pleaded and begged for before that you told them that they can't have, and they do it again and again and again until we take the proverbial stick and hit them. Not physically, I hope. And if any of you do, I'll kill you. Just, you know, not physically, but we lash out with our words. We'll lash out. We'll scream at them. We'll say hurtful things. And you could step back and say, well, that doesn't work. I know that this doesn't work. But when we lose our ability to think rationally, just like an Egyptian sitting there hearing a constant ribbit, 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 over and over and over and over, ribbit, 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 ribbit. And eventually you just take a stick and you try to beat the daylights out of whatever the cause is, even though you know it's bad, it's not going to help you. But you can't help it. When we get to that point as parents, and if you haven't gotten there yet, you're blessed. I can tell you I know what it's like to be there. As I'm sure most of you have, you end up doing something which, if you would look at yourself, if I could video you and say, so what did you think about that parenting technique you used right over there? Did you think that was like going to work? Did you think that was going to be helpful? And you say, no, that's embarrassing. But it's because we've gotten past that point. So it's important to keep in mind, just as we begin, what it means to stay calm. Remember Marvin. Just remember Marvin. Talk yourself through it. Stay calm, because it'll be more helpful to everyone involved as we go along. Okay, enough of my introductions. This particular workshop, I like to focus on two techniques. One, oh, I forgot the books. I'll bring them. Anyone familiar with Chaim Ginat and Between Parent and Child? And a book written by two of his students, Faber and Maslisch, How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. Are you familiar? Read it? So we're going to be focused on two approaches tonight. One is on that approach, which is it's a communication approach. It's an approach based on feelings of the child, getting in touch and recognizing to communicate with the child. And a second approach known as love and logic, some of you may have heard of as well, which is an entirely different approach. It's a behavioral approach, an approach that deals with us as parents and helping shape our children's behavior and respond to their behavior in productive ways. Totally different. One is more touchy-feely in terms of words and communications, and one is much more of a strict behavioral approach. If you were to read each approach, and I would recommend it highly, I think they're great, both of them, each one would say, all you need is my approach. This approach is the best technique approach. It solves all of your problems. Any situation you come up with in life, this approach has it. I've personally found that it's not quite that black and white. It's great to be armed with several. There are more than what we're doing in this particular workshop, but I have found personally in my own home and in my own life that a combination of these two, as we'll get through them by the end, each child is different, which balance, which approach is needed, every situation is different, and that's part of what parenting is being able to recognize what it is that your child needs when, But when we get through with these two, I have found that we are equipped with the tools and the skills necessary to be able to do so, and that is why I like to share it with you. What we're going to do is, again, this is from my own personal experience going to these types of workshops. I need practical. Give me what to do. The theory is all nice. Give me a scenario. How should I handle it? What should I do? What should I say? So that's how I've tried to craft this. In as much as I can, just to be focused on actual examples. So let us begin. So today's session, which is again based on Faber and Maslach, the book is called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, and Listen So Kids Will Talk. It's based on the writings of Chaim Ginat. Chaim Ginat, I'm pronouncing it Gino, his actual name was Ginsberg, I don't know when it was changed, is an Israeli Jew. He died in the 70s at the young age of 50. He was an Israeli teacher in Israel in the mid-40s and decided that he needed to know a lot more about children and parenting and education. He came here to the States and got a master's or a PhD from Columbia University and wrote a book which in its time, in the 60s, when it was written, was revolutionary for the way parents talk to their children. Much of what we're going to cover in this first session has become mainstream, so that I hope that most of you will have, if not already practicing, will have seen it or at least heard of it. But it is so critical that it's worth spending the time going over them to actually label the tool or the skill how to communicate. His book, as he writes in his introduction, his book is called Between Parents and Child. He writes, birds fly, fish swim, and people feel. They just do. Just like the birds in the air will fly and the fish in the sea will take to swimming, people feel. Children, recent studies have shown that children are very, very similar to regular people. It's true. And just like regular people have feelings, children do also. And we all know that the words that we use are extremely powerful. Sticks and stones might break my bones, but words will never harm me is possibly one of the greatest lies ever perpetuated over and over and over again in our society. Words hurt a lot. Bones will heal after 4 to 6 weeks and you'll go on like nothing ever happened. But a harsh word can stay with you forever. I would not be surprised if everyone here in this room can remember a harsh word that was said to them by a parent, teacher, or friend going all the way back to, you know, third, fourth grade, easily. And the impact that it has in the way that we live our life and how we think about ourselves. And as parents, there is nobody who gives more to our children and has the ability to impact them more, and the words that we use are therefore absolutely critical to understanding how to. If you just take a simple example, and we'll get to a bunch of examples. This time, I've been taking examples from my own home over the last 2 weeks, and it's amazing, like thousands of incidents that happened over the course of the week that you could talk about. So I'm sure if they're happening at my house, they're probably happening in your house too. A notebook was left on the dining room table of one of the children that child happened to have known needed for school, because they need it every day for school. So there should be a routine, right? A book, it gets, but it wasn't. It's on the dining room table. Now, imagine the difference between two scenarios, how the child walks out of the house to go to school this morning. In one scenario, somebody, let's just say a parent, just choosing an example, finds a notebook and says, "Whose is this?" And the said child who was supposed to have put the notebook in their backpack says, "Oh, that's mine." And the parent says, "Why is this here? Don't you know it's supposed to be in your backpack?" Because you've done this every single day for like 6 months already. It's January. And you say something like that. How does that child walk out to school? With what mindset versus the parent who says, "There's a notebook on the table," and simply walks away? There's a world of difference. Just like if your spouse were to say to you, "Are those your papers? Don't you need them for work? What are they doing here?" You would walk out of your house feeling like a pathetic individual. And you'd be upset at your spouse for talking to you that way. And your whole day is colored by that. So recent studies have shown that children would probably also be affected by that. And there are skills, simple skills that we're going to go through as to how to address What do we do in all sorts of various situations? That's a real simple one. I have another real simple one that happened just last night. Two of my children, who are capable of getting into pajamas by themselves, did, and they both, same night, put their pajama shirts on backwards. So that they came out with the, you know, the plain thing on the, picture is on the back. So it's sort of cute, right? It's sort of cute. How do you respond as a parent when you see that? So you can actually laugh and make a big deal about it, which, believe it or not, is humiliating to a child. You might think it's really cute, but the child is actually very much impacted by the way you respond. If you laugh, so for you it's just laughing at a backward shirt, that's really cute. But to a child, child sees things very differently than a parent does. That's not just the child's being laughed at. And it impacts a child. And this first book that we're going to be talking about, actually, it is an entire book about behaviors of children stem from the way that they feel. If you want to change a behavior of a child, change the way they feel about themselves and about you as a parent. And the way that we change it is about communication. Behaviors will follow their own sense of being self-assured, being self-confident. No one, none of us, wake up in the morning and think, how can I make my child's life miserable this morning? How can I nag, bother, pester them so that they are annoyed at me? None of us goes to sleep at night looking at our spouse or at ourselves and saying to ourselves, you know, the way you yell at the children at dinner time, it just reminds me of when we were dating and we were talking about having children. I see your nostrils flare and it's just so moving. No one thinks that way. No one talks that way. We don't want to have a home that way. We want to have a home that's peaceful, that's serene, that's nurturing. You know about the woman who came to her Rav after he gave a talk about having a peaceful, nurturing home. And she said, you know, I totally agree with you. I'm all in favor. And I'm almost there. About half the time, my house is peaceful and nurturing and serene. He said, it's amazing. You got to start somewhere. What's the problem with the other half? Said, well, my children are home, the other half. So like, we'd be really good at having peaceful homes if our children went around, but they're always there. And when they're there, it's a lot more difficult. So what the skills that I want to work on tonight specifically are not the behavioral method. We're going to be working on communication, on talking and listening, as the title of the book. Now, Faber Maslisch, again, I meant to bring the books and I'm sorry that I didn't. Faber Maslisch are two also Jewish women, who were students of Chaim Ginat, who took many of his workshops, became trained, and led their own workshops. They wrote a more modern book. His book was written in the 60s. They modernized it. And it's basically all of his principles just brought into 30 years later of this approach of what it means. I highly recommend it. The booklets that you have in front of you, the photocopies in the back, are all from the Faber Maslisch book. They're just photocopied cartoons. We're going to go through them because many of us learn better in visual circumstances. So we're going to see the scenarios. I always found them much more moving to see them in that manner myself. They're all from that book. I photocopy them with the hope that you'll therefore be inspired and buy the book. It is a required reading. Faber Maslisch, How to Talk to Kids. We'll listen and listen to kids. We'll talk. Let's get started going through a couple of things. Okay, number one. The opening sheet is just for me. I gave it to you as well. But it just helps me organize my thoughts, and hopefully it'll help you be able to take something out of this in terms of the organizational. Two parts to tonight's thing. We're going to talk. A, the first part is going to be talking to children, and part two will be listening to them. They're very different skills. One is, how do we talk to them? How do we communicate with them? And two, how do we listen to what they're saying? So we're going to talk about the first one first. Let's start with praise. Praise is far and away one of the most important tools that we have as a parent. Who here likes to hear praise about themselves? Yeah, if your hands aren't up, it's because you're not paying attention to me. We all love it. We love it. No matter what it is that we do, we love hearing it. We love hearing it from the people who we're closest to. We love hearing it from our spouse. We love hearing it from a parent, colleague, a coworker, a boss. Thank you. Okay, here are the two. I'll just take it. So this is the original book, Between Parent and Child, by Chaim Ginat. And this is the Faber Maslisch book. They're available in all bookstores. Even like Eichler's sells these books, even though they're not particularly Jewish books, but they're available everywhere. Excellent, highly recommended. Write them down, buy them, and read them. (Clears throat) Okay, praise is one of the most important tools that we have. I've seen in a number of different places what's known as the 80-20 rule. Some call it 90-10, 80-20. The differences are slight, but basic rule is as follows. From your child's perspective, from the home should be, the communications, the interactions in the home should be 80% positive and 20%, negative, but some form of a constructive thing where the child wouldn't say, that leaves me with the warm fuzzies. 80% should be positive. So I saw that a number of years ago. I've seen it in a number of different places, and I thought, well, obviously, I'm not a guy who yells at my kids all day long. I'm sure my house is at least, if not more, 80% positive from my child's perspective. Until after seeing that, I actually started to pay attention. And if you think about your daily routine from the time your children wake up in the morning until you get them off to school or wherever that they're going, it's usually one long string of commands. Do this. Don't do that. Get dressed. Go over here. Eat breakfast. Clean up that spill. It's just, if you'll stop and listen to what the house sounds like, dinner, bath time, and you say, from my child's perspective, how did they hear me? It would go, that's what they would hear. They're not even listening to the words anymore. They just hear one long bark. You agree? Anyway, it's like, everyone's house, that's what it sounds like. So 80% are supposed to be positive? It's impossible. I went from thinking that I was easily at 96, 97 maybe, to like 3 or 4%, because the rest is really a long string of commands and do's and don'ts. So what I'd like to accomplish tonight is show how it's possible through regular interactions to make them, what we're going to do, much more positive, and not have that negative connotation. But within the 80 rule, this is how we're going to do it. Within the 80 rule, the 80% which should be positive from the child's perspective, 50%, this is such an anonymous source that I remember seeing over the years, and the numbers don't really make a difference, 50% of your 80% should be unconditional love, and 50% should be what we would call conditional or positive praise. So that out of the, again, I'm making up the numbers, 80% of positive, it should be a half and half ratio, obviously no one's paying attention to the numbers, of, I love you just because of who you are. Not because of anything you did, I'm not responding to anything, I just want you to know that you are my child and I'm crazy about you. Now, if that's all that a child heard their whole life in their home, what would they grow up thinking they can get away with? That's right. But it's important for a child to know that. It's important for a child to know that no matter what, you are my child, and I think that I'm the luckiest parent in the world that you are my child. Those would be statements that sound something along the lines of, do you know that you're the greatest gift I ever got? And saying that over and over, several times a week. You are the cutest child I've ever seen. How is it possible that I can love you so much? How are you more beautiful today than you were yesterday? Saying things like that regularly, making an announcement Friday night at Kiddush, stopping and saying, wait a minute, this is the greatest family in the world. Where your children hear that regularly. Now, it might sound funny to you now hearing me say that and start to do it. Find words that work for you that just express, you are awesome just because you're mine, and I appreciate how lucky I am that you're mine, and you're the greatest gift I ever got. And that it should become part, you want to see them rolling their eyes because, oh, here he goes again. It's fine. It's fine that they're rolling their eyes because it seeps in that they understand that that's the reality. The other half of your 80% are actually responding to things that they've done. Because you don't want it to be where they think that they are perfect no matter what, and they can get away with anything, because our job as parents is really to model and mold them into being the people that they can be, and that's with structure. And no child grows up on their own perfectly. They grow wild as weeds. They need to be formed. The other half is positive statements responding to them in the form of praise. Now, praise is tricky. Have you ever been praised by someone and you thought to yourself, they didn't really mean it, or That didn't hit its mark. I get it all the time. This is a simple example. I finish a drush in shul. Someone will say, that was great, Rabbi. It is nothing. They're not. You know, some people actually do come over when they don't like it. When those people then say it's great, that's one thing. But the regular, that was great, doesn't tell me anything that they actually listen. I don't know anything about whether or not it meant anything to them, it accomplished anything. There's a evaluative praise and there's descriptive praise. And very often we fall into evaluating and we say that was terrific, it was fantastic, it was wonderful. But what really means things to us as people is when the praise is descriptive. It describes what it is that we did. Somebody recognizes it and says, what you did was wonderful. And they tell you what it is that you did. Now I know that they got it, they paid attention, and you feel like $1 million when someone's able to describe, when you said this, when you tied that together like that, that was fantastic. That's a meaningful form of praise. It's very hard, and this is the first tool, if you want to flip to the very back of your sheets, is the little cartoon. Again, these cartoons are straight from the book of Faber and Maslisch. On the back page is the title, Descriptive Praise. So for those of you who like to see cartoons, we'll just go through one or two. In the first one, instead of evaluating, you cleaned your room. What a good girl you are. What a mitzvah boy you are. What a mitzvah girl. Oh, you're so good. Those kinds of evaluating and describing with the person. Well, what's a natural response when someone hears, what a good girl you are? And she could think, I'm not so good. I stuffed the toys under the bed. As we often do, whenever someone just evaluates you, you think of all the times why it's not true. You think that I'm like this. Well, you don't really know the whole truth. I'm sometimes like that. So a different type of praise is, and the second scene, I see a lot of work has been going on here. All the blocks are back on the shelf. Every record is in its jacket. Every single marble has been picked up. I point out to my child what they have done. You put these toys back over there, and this toy over here, and that type of description, when a person is praised for what they did, they know that it's accurate. I'm not afraid of sometimes thinking, you know what you're saying isn't accurate, it's not really true. You're talking about this, but I know that it really isn't that way. We defend ourselves, we have defense mechanisms against praise when we think it might not necessarily be true. But if you can describe, then it becomes revival. A two-year-old child brings a picture to you. And it's a two-year-old, three-year-old child. There's scribble, there are different colors, circles, all sorts of the mess of a drawing. And they say, Mommy, what do you think? How is it? Look, whatever words they use. So most of us naturally respond and say, oh, it's so beautiful, it's so wonderful, all kinds of like that. Now, which may or may not be true, the child might respond and think it's ugly. We don't know what they're thinking. The best way to respond to that is, to say, wow, look, I see a red circle here and an orange line over here, and then you must have put some green over there. I have seen children's faces light up in that. I had a situation soon after having given this workshop once, a couple years ago. We had guests in the house, and on Sunday morning, the guests had a two-year-old who came in that exact scenario with their paper. And the father said, we were talking in the kitchen, and he said, oh, it's beautiful. I said, wow, I see you did a green circle here, and there's a red squiggly line over here, and an orange dot over there. And the kid took it, and he ran back into the playroom, and then he came back a minute later, and he'd added something. And I said, wow, now I see a green circle over here, and a red circle there, and there's a purple line over there. He ran back, and he came back again 5 times, just running back and forth, because someone was not saying, oh, it was great. Someone was saying, this is what you did. I had an older child, 7 or 8, was goalie. He played a fantastic game in goal. He gave up 1 goal the whole game. He gets into the car and I said, you were awesome today. And he says, no, I wasn't. I let up a goal. And it's a reminder, that's right. If you tell him he's awesome, but what's he thinking about? He's thinking about the goal that he let up. Meanwhile, he made 6 fantastic saves, and that was a reminder to me. This is if you ever see me with a notebook watching my kids play soccer, it's because trying to think, like that play where you did X, Y, or Z, and then oh, remember when you did this play? When you get back to the car and you can repeat to your child what they did, you say, remember on that play when he was breaking the front? They remember it all. And they are happy to talk about it because you're not just telling them that they were awesome, at which point he says, I wasn't awesome, I gave up a goal. You describe what it is that he did. When they're in a school play, And you say, not just you were fantastic, but you had this type of presence, and you said that line so funny when you did it. I can describe, it is not, I don't even know if it sounds easy. I know it's not easy. I've been practicing it for years, and I fail miserably most of the time in being able to do so. To be able to notice, and that's really the hard part. Many of you have probably heard from me my former pet peeve about mitzvah notes. I used to hate mitzvah notes. Hate them, because the children who need mitzvah notes are usually young, which means when the young children in the house, getting out of the house in the morning is a disaster, and who remembers the night before? So it's always right before you think you're able to get out of the house, some kid says, can I have a mitzvah note? And it's a mess. Just to hate it, because then what would happen is, oh, God, mitzvah note. Let's see, what'd you do yesterday? And it occurred to me, how horrible it was that I had no idea what my child had done that was noteworthy from the entire previous day. And now if they would have asked, can I have a note that describes the thing that I need improvement on? No problem. I'll give you the list. But a mitzvah note? So I remember thinking, what would be if one of us went up to our spouse, a boss, a parent, and said, say something nice about me. Tell me, well, what did you do yesterday? Like, well, I'm the worst feeling in the world. That would be horrible. Like, nothing, you can't come up with anything that I did. We were together for a whole 24 hours. Nothing. So I was thinking, like, what's my poor little 4-year-old thinking that I'm sitting here, like, moaning and groaning about writing a mitzvah note? So it occurred, like, that is what it means to be able to have descriptive praise means I'm paying attention. I am aware, it's a whole different set of eyes that is always on the lookout to see and be able to describe it. And you don't have to wait for the morning, for the mitzvah note. It should just be a regular part of our vocabulary with our children, mixed in with the unconditional statements that just let them know that they're the most wonderful, amazing people, that we love them for who they are. And mixed in with that half and half, they're hearing repeated back to them actual things that they have done. And there is nothing as building up for a child as being able to hear that their parent sees and recognizes and is able to state as a fact what they're able to do. I have on the first page there, under praise, can you snap? Now, snap is an abbreviation for strengths, needs, abilities, and preferences. I was thinking about actually taking a few moments now, but I'll give it to you for homework. Every parent needs to be able to answer this question for every child that they have. On the spot, should be, now I was thinking, I don't know if I'd be able to on the spot do that, but be able to stop and think and say, can I answer this question? What are my child's strengths? And strengths more in an emotional sense, like do they have insight, patience, organized, not like can they play ball, and that's for ability. What are their strengths? What are their needs? This child, what does this child need from me? Does this child need more time to get ready in the morning? Do they need more patience? Do they need more love? Do they need more distance? Do they need more guidance? What does this child need? Every child is different. What are their abilities? And what are their preferences? What preferences in many different areas. Do they prefer chocolate versus vanilla ice cream? Do they prefer, what do they prefer in their lunches versus what do they prefer to spend their free time doing? What do they prefer? How do they prefer to be spoken to? We'll come up with it. We have a bunch of different things. What are they for each child? And it was novel to me, and I share it with you that when I heard this, and I was like, wow, that's pretty interesting. I don't know if I can answer that for my child. Really? You can't answer that? I was thinking to myself, for your own child? And the answer was no, because I never stopped to think about it and identify clearly in writing for myself, these are the strengths, these are the needs, these are the abilities, and these are the preferences. So that we're in a much better position to give out praise and know what needs to be done and where we can be focused in general if we actually have that, and we'll see how different our children are. Those with multiple children in the room already know they're all different. They have different snaps, each and every one of them. Dr. Pelkovitz, Dr. David Pelkovitz, is a well-known psychologist in the New York area. He writes in one of his books about the bumper sticker, your family's bumper sticker. If your family were to have a bumper sticker, what would it be? Now, different families, some would be a scholar, or be Bal Chesed. We stand for kindness. This family stands for a combination of both. This family stands for excelling in sports and in academics, or just in academics, whatever it may be. Every family, more often than not, actually would have an identifiable bumper sticker, which the family itself might not recognize, but if you would ask your friends, they would tell you what your bumper sticker is. You as a family really value X, and it comes a lot from what the parents value. If the parents value whatever it may be, so then that's what the family is going to value. If it's in athletics, if it's in academia, if it's in Torah, if it's in chesed, if it's in any other number of things, whatever it may be. Well, if you can identify that, and then you look at your children and you see, well, out of my three children, two of them really naturally are inclined to that as well, and that one doesn't. What's it like being a child, growing up in a home where there's an identifiable bumper sticker of the values of this family, the child doesn't fit? I wouldn't ask you to raise your hands. How many of you can identify in your own lives, having grown up within your family of origins bumper sticker or without, and what it's like when you're on the outside, when your parents have a clear value system and you don't quite fit in? So these skills of how to talk and to communicate and to give out praise and to have 80% positive, half and half between unconditional love, are important to know your child and what they're going through and what it's like being raised in your own home, when you can identify those things and then you're able to better speak to them. Okay, let's move on. Let's get to some other practical tools. Engaging cooperation. So a number of things. These are just short tools. These are things that I have come across or discovered, mostly coming across and trying out and finding them to be extremely successful. Hopefully you do a bunch of these on your own, but it's worth just having them on paper so you can go home and practice them. The two-minute warning. Two-minute warning is great. I don't mean warnings in the sense of you have a warning. Right, I'm going to count to three. We're talking about that next week and how not in favor I am personally in terms of those. I mean warnings in the sense of 2 minutes to bath time kind of warnings. If you, again, go back to the fact that most studies show that children are very much like regular people, if you can think about our own lives, what it's like if you're in the middle of doing something and then someone out of the blue says, take out the garbage. Like, wow, I'm in the middle of this. And they say, take out the garbage. I just said, take out the garbage. Like, I'm getting to it. I'm in the middle of doing something. So we don't appreciate that because we're in the middle of doing something. But if someone would say, if in the next 5 minutes you could just take care of this because it really smells and it would be a help to me, so then, okay, fine, I got 5 minutes to do it. I'll finish up what I'm doing and I can take care of it. So our children playing Lego in the playroom is just as significant to them as whatever important task that we're busy with when someone demands something of us. And it's just as unfair to them to say, they're playing in the park, and say, okay, time to go. And then, how come they're not listening to me? How come they're still trying to finish up and get their last swing in, or the last ride over here? That is just as difficult for them, and the ability to say to them, okay, in 5 minutes we're leaving, finish up your last couple of things. 3 minutes are going to be finished. One more minute. You will find, it is the simplest of tools that is amazingly effective just in all sorts of things. From little kids telling them when they're going to eat supper to a bigger kid who's playing ball outside when you want to have him come. Just 5 minutes. We're leaving in 3 minutes. Just let them have a sense to get a understanding of what's going on. Are they still like playing in the back? Two more minutes until we have to come out. Whatever it may be, all of those things are extremely helpful. And then to expect compliance. What I mean by that is what I call the kiddish dance. And that's my own phraseology. The kiddish dance is where a husband says to his wife during kiddish on Shabbos, okay, it's time to go. Let's leave, let's say, in 2 minutes. And they follow 2 minutes, we're going. Great. 2 minutes comes and goes, and he sees, he's waiting, and he's standing there by the door, and he's waiting, and she's having this conversation, and he knows she's going to finish up soon because it's time to go, and he's waiting, he's standing there. So he figures, while he's just standing there doing nothing, So if somebody walks out, so he says good Shabbos to them and strikes up a brief conversation, waiting to see when she's going to be finished. Meanwhile, she's over here. She sees, oh, he started a conversation. We're not leaving anytime soon. So she keeps going. I mean, he's looking over her saying, like, why don't... He has no interest in talking to this person. He's only talking to this person because he has nothing else to do while he's sitting around waiting for her. So he's keeping the conversation going as best he can. And meanwhile, she's looking at him, thinking, well, he's totally engaged in this conversation, and she can keep on going. So that happens with our children all the time. In the sense of, we say, okay, time to leave. And they look at us, and what are we doing? We're standing there waiting for them to leave. Because we think that our children should take the first step, and they should, right? Oh, yes, Mom, and pick themselves up and run to the car. So they're playing, and we're standing there saying, okay, it's time to leave. And they're looking at us saying, well, it's not time to leave. They're still standing there doing whatever they're doing. And they're waiting for us to go to know it's time to leave. Okay, whenever we're going to go, we're going to go. And we think that they should make the first move. Children, they don't make the first move. They're going to go when it's time to go. You told them it's time to go. I have found, and I don't mean this in a way of like threatening to leave your children in the park. I go, I'm going now. If you don't come, I'm leaving. I don't mean that. I mean, okay, it's time to leave, and then you go. You actually go through the motions of leaving. You will find, without threatening, not in a sense in which they were afraid they're going to be left behind, like, okay, right, it's time to go, and we're leaving now, and they come with you, as opposed to what I have witnessed in parks for many, many, many years, where the parents are literally just standing there as if waiting for the child to leave first. The child will follow you. You expect that they're going to go. You can expect that they're going to follow you into the dining room for dinner, whatever it may be. If they don't, and it becomes a problem, that's next week's love a lot. That's a behavioral approach. But just as far as how to talk to them, give them the warning, tell them what's coming, and then do it. You will find, and I'm happy to hear if your experience is not that way, but certainly with teaching them and training them that this is how things work around here, they will actually be running right behind you, and they'll actually get to the car before you once they see that it is time to go. I have found that over and over again. So that's number one, 2-minute warning. Next tool and skill are choices. This, again, I'm sure most of you are familiar with, but it's just worth stating as far as the more healthy control a child has, the less unhealthy control he or she will try to get. The more they have that's healthy, the less that they will strive to take from us that is unhealthy. Healthy control is, would you like to come out of the bath by yourself, or would you like me to help you out? Do you want to pick out your pajamas yourself, or would you like me to pick them out? Things along those lines. Giving them choices regularly. Now, I don't mean to overdo this. I witnessed one parent who made every single thing in the child's life a choice, where the child was paralyzed unless they were given two options. They couldn't think unless they were either this or that, because not everything has to be a choice, but it's something to get accustomed to. When the child's in the bath and doesn't want to come out, you can say, here's your towel. Would you like to do this yourself in a few minutes, or would you like me to do it with you now? And you will let them do it themselves if the child is capable of doing so, or if not, you can. They figure those kinds of things out. Picking their own pajamas. Do you want to get in your bed? I have a child who likes to climb into his crib. Do you want to climb in yourself tonight, or would you like me to do it? Things along those lines, providing choices for the child in things that are reasonable, that you're okay with both options, is a simple way to simply to give them the choice, the control. Every child wants independence. We want our child and children to become independent and to make decisions. And so give them the opportunities to do so, in which not everything is being fed to them. As they get older, the choices obviously change. But it starts with them learning and being trained. You have options. It's totally fine. You could do it this way or that way. Either one is fine with me. Go ahead and choose. Now, the other tools that I'd like to discuss as far as engaging cooperation have to do with having their letter C, describe, give info, or say it with a word. These are all based on your drawings, which you have. I'm going to flip to the first drawing that you have. These are all simple tools, and I want to share them with you. You have them in your booklets here. We'll go through them quickly. As a way of talking to our children, which remove a lot of the animosity. Describe simply states as a fact whatever the problem or issue is. We don't need to say anything other than describe the problem. I walk into the kids' bathroom and there's clothing everywhere. They've been told 1,000 times to put away their clothing after their bath, and they did it. How do I respond? They're busy playing, which you're not supposed to be doing because the bathroom hasn't been cleaned up. You walk in, And the inclination is to say something that sounds like, I told you 1,000 times to clean up the bathroom before you go out. Something along those lines, whatever variation of words you would use. Versus simply walking in and saying, I still see clothing on the floor. And walking out. Just describe the problem. Because when a child is told or yelled at, you need to do this or you didn't do this, what happens when we're told that? Our gut reaction is?
You're the problem.
Correct. Right, you're the problem. Go back to my taking out the garbage issue. I told you 10 minutes ago to take out the garbage. Your response? Like, leave me alone. Go do it yourself. Anything along those words. Versus simply saying, garbage. Oh yeah, I forgot. It's not as offensive. Still see the garbage there when you have a chance. And it's we're much better at that with adults. And with children, we sometimes think that we have a right to come down much harder rather than simply describe what it is. Right? The child's in the bath. Just the water's getting near the top. Just describe what it is that needs to be done. Shoes are still in the front. I still see the milk out on the table. The kids are in the playroom. Breakfast is over and the milk has been left out again. Just describe. The milk is still out. And walk out. Just let them they'll figure it out. They don't need to be told. As soon as you say you or you didn't, you need to, everyone's gut reaction to that, children included, is I don't want to do what you are telling me to do. So just describe what needs to be done. It's a very simple tool. And when you talk about the interactions of your home in the mornings and at night, where it's one steady stream of barking, this simple tool, the difference between how you say it is so minute, but the atmosphere in the home is so much healthier when you simply say, there's a light left on in the bathroom. You don't have to point any fingers, you don't have to call out anybody, you don't have to say any names. The child will hear and get the message. You can look at all of the pictures I'm describing. Giving information is very similar. Milk turns sour when it's left out. Simply saying apple cores belong in the garbage. You can look at the pictures and study them. They're all the same line of describing or saying it in a word. Pajamas, you don't need to give a whole speech telling your child how many times you've already told them to get into pajamas. Just state it in a word. Pajamas, kids, pajamas. Leave it at that. Leave it without the direction. As soon as you must, you have to, I told you already, will totally just change the entire nature of what you have. And you'll find, in the way that I want to present this in combination with what we'll do next week is how do we respond to when they don't listen. Tonight is just how to talk to them. So next week we'll deal with, what happens when I say I do it correctly. I give them a 3-minute warning. I give them a 1-minute warning. I say it in a word. I just describe the problem and they don't do it. Then what? That'll be next week. And again, you need to take them all in stride as to how to maintain that calm in that situation where you're doing everything that you want to be doing and it doesn't seem to be working. And lastly on this is talking about your feelings. This is something which, again, has become very mainstream, the I statement as opposed to the you statement. But we have to practice it when it comes to our children. Our children like to pull at us. They like to yank at us. They like to try to kick at our shins. They like to yell at us when we're trying to talk on the phone. They like to do all of those things. And the statements have to come out as, and it's totally fine for a child to hear how we feel about things, I don't like being spoken to that way. I will respond to you when you talk to me nicely. I don't like being hit, and I don't appreciate being pulled at, whatever it is, but it always is coming from the I. When you say, you can't hit me, the child's response is going to be, oh yes I can, and I'm going to do it again. Because that's what we think when our boss says that to us, in whatever form he does. It's always got to be, I don't like being hit. Don't appreciate it, I won't accept being hit. I won't accept being spoken to that way. I will listen to you when you talk to me in a different way. But it has to come from the I, as far as just going through a list of different ways to change the way that we talk and communicate. Lastly, the last thing I want to do as far as how we talk to our children for tonight is stop saying no. Now, this is an actually difficult task because if you were to count, if you take a child that's 4 or 5 years old on a shopping trip with you and you count the amount of questions that they ask, it'll probably be between 30 and 50 if it's a quick 10-minute shopping trip. Probably 30 to 50. Can we have this? Can I buy that? Can we go here? Can I do that? It's just one steady thing. And the answer to all of them actually is No. That is the answer. No, you can't. But what happens if the dynamic in your house is one steady stream of can I? No. It's not what we want in our houses. So how do we get around the problem to the fact that most of our children's requests have to be rejected, and yet we don't want to get into this constant, that the whole home is based on a constant stream of no's. So tools that we can use. Number one, instead of telling them no, get into the habit of telling them when or how they can. Can we have ice cream? So it's 5 o'clock, it's right before dinner. The answer is no. So instead of saying no, you can say, we can have tomorrow, right when you get back from school, or we can have Friday, you know, before Shabbos, or whatever it is that you think it would be. But instead of saying no, what do they need to do to have it? Or you can say, when you finish supper, you can. That's one of the greatest ways to get a child, to motivate a child to do something that you actually need them to do, is when they ask to do something they want to do, and the response is, sure, after you do X, Y, or Z. It doesn't come across as a no, although as your children get older, they'll realize that it is. But it's still fine because you've given them what it is that they need to do. They want to play. Can I play on the computer? No. After you finish your homework. So I've said no, but I've actually given the child something that they can do to get what it is that they want, which is totally fine. Sure, as soon as you finish homework, you can have that. So that I give them the when or the how, and it's, again, a simple tool just to keep in mind as the questions come, to think about, instead of saying no, which the answer almost always is, get more information. I had a situation where my 3.5-year-old asked right before going to sleep, she was in the same room as the baby with his crib. She asked if she could, they're on the opposite sides of the room. She went and she said, can I move my bed next to his crib? Now, I can give you 1,000 reasons why that's a terrible idea. And that there was no way that she was going to be able to do that. So I was about to say, no. Later, I said, why would you like to do that? Which is another simple thing. Instead of just right away closing off the discussion, finding out what's really behind it. Why do you want to do that? And she said, because I can't see the clock from over there, but I can if I would be over there. Oh. I said, well, let's say we kept your bed over there. Do you think we can move the clock somewhere that you'd be able to see it? And she said, yeah. How about over there? I said, great. Move the clock. And discussion was over, as opposed to the way that it otherwise would have gone, which would have been a no, yes, no, yes. Now, none of us like getting involved in that because we've lost as soon as we've gotten engaged. And instead, with a simple question, all of a sudden discovered what was really behind it, and the whole situation plays out entirely different. So those are just some concepts as far as taking the word no as much as possible out of our vocabulary. Even if you're really good at this, you'll still find yourself saying no 10 to 20 times a day, but it's better than 75 to 100, which really, it's just not pleasant for anyone. And you can use their questions to get them to do so many things. What they need to be doing. I want to do this? Sure. After you finish doing this? Sure. We can do that then. Sure. Here. So I'm really saying no, but I'm giving them a way to be able to get it what it is that they want. Okay. That's it for part one. Let's see where we're holding on time. Okay. I'm going to try to just do this in 15 minutes, and we'll finish within that. Okay. Part two is listening. This is all about how to talk to our children. Again, Faber Maslisch. How to talk to children, listen to children, talk, buy the book, read it, it's all based, most of this has been based on what they have to say in there. The next big section of this first part of this workshop is listening to our children. A very difficult task as well, because we like to give quick responses and answer their questions and not really hear what it is that they are trying to say. So the first thing that we need to recognize is that once children get emotional, the game, don't try to do anything. Because children are very much like people. And when people get emotional, they are irrational. That's why we use the term emotional, because they're functioning on emotion and not using the other parts of their brain. So when children throw a tantrum, it's not the time, you can't reason with them at that moment. So recognize what's going on, recognize what can and cannot happen during those moments, and deal with it as such. If most of the time it means waiting and being patient. To avoid getting to that stage is letter B, don't deny their feelings. This is, if anything, I would say the most critical on how to listen to a child. A child comes home, younger children and on up, and they say all sorts of things which are laden with emotions, and we reject them, we deny them. Simple things like, the soup is too hot. And we say, no, it's not. Or they say, I'm not cold. And we say, it's cold outside. Or they say, I hate my brother. And we say, no, you love your brother. And we do things like that all the time because we aren't ready to tolerate. Sometimes we just disagree with them. The soup's not hot. So they say it's hot. We say it's not hot. We say it's cold outside. They say, I'm not cold. So what, in essence, we're doing with that is consistently telling them not to trust or believe in whatever that they're saying, and that we will be the ones to tell them how or what to think or feel. We'll tell you when the soup is too hot for you or not. I have this as an adult. My fingers are very sensitive to cold. So when the temperature drops, usually into just the 50s, I already have my gloves on. Because if I don't, my fingers turn red and they hurt. So I put on gloves. It's a really simple solution for me. But what do I get regularly, every single time, first Shabbos that's in the 50s, and I'm walking home from shul and I have my gloves on? Because my fingers get red and they hurt if I don't. As do my ears. So I have earmuffs. It's like 50 degrees. Everyone's walking without a coat. And I have my gloves and my earmuffs. I didn't make my body this way. What should I do? I'm just trying to keep myself warm and not in pain. And I can't even tell you how many comments I get. It's not cold outside. How about let's make a deal? I agree when it's cold for me, and you decide when it's cold for you, and you leave me out of your decision when it's cold outside. Who are you to tell me if it's cold outside? So until this day, like as adults, I have people regularly coming out, and they're like, as if I didn't know, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize it wasn't cold, let me take off my gloves and earmuffs. I thought it was. Thank you for telling me that it's not. Well, I appreciate it, thank you. So we do the same things to our children, in which we tell them what it is. Maybe their soup is too hot for them. Why do we think that it's not too hot? The bath water, it's too hot, it's too cold. So we have to first get into the sense of not denying their feelings. The other time that we deny the feelings, if you look at the cartoon, which is a great one, I'll give you a real-life example of that in a second, is the one with the turtle. It's a little bit farther in. I think, yeah, it's on page 7. It's towards the back. This, we deny feelings because we don't know what to do with them. And this is much more serious than just telling the soup is too hot or too cold. You have your little girl, everyone see where I am on this page with the turtle? It's page 7 on the bottom of your cartoon. So a girl comes home from school and her turtle is dead. And she says, my turtle is dead. It was alive in the morning. Now, the first set of responses on the left-hand side is what we as parents would normally do. We would say, oh, you know, don't get so upset. It's just a turtle. And so she begins to cry and poor dad is trying to convince her not to be upset that it's just a turtle. I'll buy you another one, he says. And she doesn't want another turtle, so she's having a tantrum and he doesn't know what to do. This whole scene is one of my favorites. It's just, I read it like several times a week when I'm preparing this, and I find myself doing this. So what's the other response? So now we struggle with this because it's hard for us as parents to deal with this. Child comes home and says, my turtle is dead. So the father responds and doesn't deny the child's feelings. Like, don't worry about it. Don't be sad. Don't be upset. The child is upset. Something happened. We as a parent can say, well, in the scheme of things, the turtle's not all that important. Well, maybe to us it's not, but to the child it is. And the child is now experiencing a trauma, something that's bothering it. And you can't say to such a child, don't worry about it. It's nothing. It's not a big deal. It is a big deal. What a shock, the father says. He was my friend. Oh, to lose a friend can hurt. I taught him to do tricks. You had fun together. Now, the father, you can't solve the problem. The turtle is dead. But I can put names on the emotions and the feelings that the child is experiencing. That must be so shocking. That must be painful. It's hurtful to lose something that you cared about. I'm sad for you, and I see that you're so sad. In that situation, the child, I can't solve it. I had this on a Friday, Hanukkah, which is always a crazy time, trying to light Hanukkah candles and getting to shul, and I had bought extra large, colorful candles for the kids. I had oil, so I had enough oil to last for a while, but for the kids, we're using the usual, the small Hanukkah lights. For Friday night, we had bought a box of longer ones. Well, we had bought it the previous year when Shabbos was, I don't know, maybe on the first or second night, so we didn't use most of it. So we had a lot left over for this year, but it was, I think, the sixth night maybe this year was kind of. And now there are a lot more kids who are lighting. So there were, of the three big kids, the four big kids all had enough of the big candles. But for my beautiful Rina Leah, who's four, there was only two left for the sixth night of Hanukkah. So I set up for menorah Friday afternoon. Everything was crazy. Two big ones and four little ones. Well, wouldn't you know, 10 minutes before Shabbos, we're all getting ready to light. It's crazy. And poor Rina Leah sees that she's the only one without a full menorah of big candles. And wouldn't you know what Rina Leah does? Just, you know, she's distraught. She can't believe how unfair and unjust this world is. That everyone else got big candles and she didn't. Now, I, not having gone through a workshop in any recent memory, and totally harried because we had the light within 10 minutes and I had to get to Jewel, started saying things along the lines of, well, really, see, you only really need one. So you have one. So really, you're good. The rest is on. So she's crying and it's not going to help at all. So I started going into, well, you see, you're the fifth child. So we started from the top and we just ran out. And that didn't work either. And she's just like, it's a mess. She's totally lost it. And I can't fix it because I don't have enough. I don't have enough. And then I remembered the turtle. And that's why I give you the drawings, because it helps me all the time. I go back to the, oh yeah, that picture. I remember the picture and the turtle. And I said, oh, Rina, you're so sad that you don't have enough candles. Yeah, everybody else has but me. And I said, I know, I wish I would have had enough for everyone. She said, yeah, it's not fair. I said, do you think anything we can do about this? And she said, yeah, next year when you buy candles, make sure you buy enough for me. And I said, that's a great idea. Next year we're going to make sure that we have enough for everybody. And the problem was solved.
Can I ask, why don't you just have the older kids each give up one candle?
Yeah, because that goes back to the opening story of when you're harried, you don't think straight. And then you fall back to all sorts of other things that don't work out well. But I could have done something like that. I don't know that it would have worked. But even that would have worked, but it's actually sometimes there aren't enough. In other words, that would have worked in this situation. Yeah, then all 5 minutes. But sometimes it really is like the goldfish dies, the turtle dies. There is no solution. There really is no solution, but the job that child comes home from school and says, I hate my teacher. So the gut reaction of a parent is, no, you don't hate your teacher, or what'd you do? Or what? But it's a matter of, wow, you sound really upset. Get into the child is expressing a strong emotion that most of the children that you have in this room or still younger don't know how to deal with. They don't know how to deal with anger and being extremely upset or jealous or frustrated, and we have to put words and name what it is they're expressing. That sounds really frustrating. What happened? And you'll see, if you give them an opportunity to talk, as opposed to telling them that they don't really have the feeling that they're having, no, you don't hate your teacher, or blaming them or accusing them, let them tell the story as to what happened. You will find, just in having them be heard, just like adults like to be heard, we can actually put an emotion on what it is that they're experiencing, which very many times goes a long distance to addressing whatever it is. And allowing them to express themselves without jumping to conclusions is one of the greatest tools. If you take a look at, just give you one more to look at here. If you flip back a page, the mother and the boy with his cereal. Just flipping away. He wants his toasty crunchies. And this is what I want. I say, I don't have them for you. Classic example. It's whatever day of the week it is, might be Shabbos morning, Sunday morning, who knows what it is, your child wants something to eat, and it's, you don't have it. So you can go through an entire dialogue, as we have over here, I want them, we don't have them, and he throws the whole tantrum, and that goes on in many houses all the time. But you can talk it through and give the child his wish in his fantasy. He wants it. They say, oh, I wish I had some to give you. Which I wish I had a magic box which can produce them. Or if I can give you any cereal in the world, which one would you want? Play out their desires. Give them a chance to express it. Acknowledge the hurt or the disappointment or the sadness that they have and say, is there something else that you would like? And if they say no, you can say no. And you can just leave them there. We'll talk more about that last week, what to do with a child who's having a tantrum in the kitchen. But you can't deny or try to work against the fact that that's what they want and say that they really either want something else or have to have that. If you go up to one other, flip back one other. Yeah.
Okay. Serial experience.
Yeah.
That I had been on the buying cereal that was like not the norm.
Right.
That my kids will eat. Or I'll eat.
Calamity.
And I just bought it. And they're like, oh. The novelty item that we ran out of.
Okay.
Had to have, and he couldn't eat a cereal without.
Right, so.
Yeah,
so you know what they say?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Not necessarily. You don't have to be honest. Like, this is what we have. If you don't, and listen, if he doesn't want to eat the cereal that you have, he doesn't have to eat that cereal. And there's always saying, that's an example of us all the time. You pour a kid a juice. They want juice. You give them juice. They say, I want more. So how do you respond to the child who's sitting there screaming, I want more than that. That's not enough.
Yeah.
Right? Anyone ever had that before?
Yeah.
Right? So you can say, well, when you finish that, if you'd like more, I'll be happy to give you more. I want more now. Say, you don't have to have this. I'm going to put it here on the counter. If you like it, here it is. And if you finish it, I'll be happy to give you more. And you can walk away from the situation, and you'll see the child will either throw a tantrum or usually will pick up the juice and drink it and then ask politely for more, because that's the rules that you're setting up. So in your situations, you're like, you know, we don't have that cereal right now. This, you know, if you don't want to do with this particular cartoon of giving them their wish and their friend, things don't always work out as smoothly as they do in the cartoons. That's what I've discovered, which is why, it's true. That's why next week's session, when Love and Logic really helps deal with the response, this is how to talk and how to address and how to acknowledge feelings. Let me do one more cartoon, and I'll let you go for the night. If you flip back one other question, one other cartoon, you have the girl who starts with, somebody stole my new red pencil. Another classic one of how to listen to what a child comes home with a story, how to listen to their story. Somebody stole my new red pencil. So a parent will often have the response, as you have here, of, are you sure you didn't lose it? So they come in with a story, and we're right away accusing or giving them another option, what took place? So she says, no, I didn't lose it, it was on my desk. And well, what do you expect? You left things lying around, and then the mother launches into a whole tirade, and the girl says basically, you know, leave me alone, I'm not interested in you. As opposed to just acknowledging the story, allowing the child to finish what they have to say. Somebody stole my red pencil. Saying, wow, what happened? Not accusing, did you do this? Did you do that? Let them express, somebody stole my, that must be upsetting. Or, you know, what took place? What do you think happened? And let the child, and they will often have plenty what to say if we will only give them the chance without already giving them our advice, questioning them, blaming them. Give them the opportunity to speak, to express what it is that they have to say. Listen to what it is there. Their questions, often when a child asks a question, the question doesn't mean what they're actually asking. Like in a simple example, we were driving down to Florida just last week, so my four-year-old asked an hour after the baby had a cheese stick, said, how come a baby gets to eat cheese sticks? Now, you don't need to be a parenting expert to know that when a child who's four asks an hour after the one-year-old had a cheese stick, how come he's allowed to eat cheese sticks, that what she's asking is, can I have a cheese stick? But most of their questions are very similar to that, in which they might ask one thing, but they're really asking about lots of other things while they're asking questions. In Chaim Ginat's book, so he opens with a kindergartner, a five-year-old who walks into, or a six-year-old who walks into kindergarten with her mother in a new school, and says, there's a picture that was drawn by another child on the wall, and says, who drew that ugly picture? And so the mother's embarrassed that her child would speak their way and says, it's not nice to call such a pretty picture an ugly picture. But the teacher, who understood what the child was asking, said, well, in this classroom, you can draw any type of picture you'd like. You could draw mean pictures or ugly pictures. It's all okay. Which satisfied the child who really wanted to know what happens if you don't really know how to draw so well. and wasn't really concerned with the name of the child who drew their picture, who she doesn't know anybody in the classroom, but what happens if you draw pictures that don't necessarily look well? And there's an emotional component often behind the child's question to try to understand, question their questions. Don't always look to give advice or to answer. See what it is that they have that's going on within their questions, and you'll discover many, many other things. Okay, I'm going to leave it for here for tonight. Next week we'll do a little bit more with Faber Maglish, and then we'll do a little bit of Love and Logic, and then I hope we'll put it together in terms of a whole picture and trying to figure out when to use which tools and which skills. The homework we did a whole bunch of things tonight, between praise and snaps and two-minute warnings and choices, is I would say to choose two and to pay attention, go over it with your spouse, and pay attention to, over the course of your week, things too that you don't necessarily do. Find those two and pay attention to how you can do things in a different way, and note the impact that it has on the atmosphere and environment in your home. Look forward to seeing you next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.